Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Let's Grill Jeannie call. Today is April the 13th. For those of you on the call, welcome aboard. We just had the business coaching in Boston, and Dave was awesome with many, many good nuggets of information. Followed up with Bob Bowman and Diane Bowman doing the Commercial Training Academy, and they did an amazing job as well. So I'd like to welcome all the new Mastery students from Baltimore and Washington, D.C. Don't forget to send in your confirmation forms for the immersion training coming up May 5th through the 7th. And if you have not sent in your student data form, please do so as soon as possible so we can assign your coach and get you rocking and rolling. Just a general reminder, the UP9 event is $695 and is coming up July the 28th to the 30th in Boston, Mass. We're going to roll right into the high five, and then we'll start with questions. So the high five is going to Ozzy Khan from Sterling, Virginia. Ozzy purchased 176 units in Dallas for $3.6 million a couple of years ago, and he was able to refinance it this year and take out $6 million in equity. Property is still cash flowing like crazy. He also purchased $4 million in commercial properties, both office and retail, and he flipped over 150 single-family homes. He is just one of the successful students who's coming up and going to be at the UP9 event. So those were that's my high five and my little status. I'm going to open it up for questions, and then if we don't have any, I have some questions that were faxed in. Operator, are you on the call?
So if you want to ask a question, press star zero, and we'll get you into the queue. You want to do it right now rather than later, because we have a meeting right after this call, so don't be waiting until the last 5 minutes of the call to start zeroing in on questions. So press star zero if you have a question.
Okay, so while we're waiting for them to queue up, I'm going to ask the first question that was emailed in. We have been very successful with Dave's system for some time now. We bought a couple of apartment buildings that cash flowed well, and then last year we sold them, tripling our investment. But now we want to do something in Denver, which is our backyard, and the market is crazy expensive. The numbers never work. Any ideas in a market like this? We don't want to buy high and then have the market cycle go down in a few years and have the property value and the rents and cash flow go down. Any advice would be appreciated. Thanks, Virginia.
Well, we said to be looking in your local market, become an expert. There is deals there. Do a direct mail piece. We buy on cash flow, so you need to put the deal together so it works. But and you should be building your power team in your local market too, because those are the people that eventually, when you do decide what market to go into, that you'll be able to bring some of those people in as some of your private money contacts or investors into outside of the merchant market. So become an expert. It might be smaller deals that you're looking for that cash flows, but hey, we're still buying cash flows, three families in this area based on cash flow because they are in our local market. I've found that many of my most successful students are those students that are very active in their local market and have picked an emerging market just one at a time, started building a power team there, got deal flow coming in, and then as soon as they've closed a couple of properties, because remember, the first property is always the hottest, and then on average in our program, the second deal comes in about 60 days afterwards because people know you're a closer. Pretty soon those real estate brokers that have been giving you those crappy deals start giving you some of their off-market deals, and your deal flow increases, and then they decide to go into another market afterwards. But always concentrate in your local market first, an emerging market, just one, and that's a good path for this multifamily business. Okay. We're ready for we're ready for a question from the operator. Has anyone pressed *0? And if you don't have a question, just say who you are, where you're from.
Okay, our first question comes from Jose. Jose, please state your question.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Jeff. Jose Rivera from San Antonio, Texas. How are you guys?
Good.
We're doing good.
Awesome. I have a kind of general question. Financials and OMs that we receive from brokers, they include what they call principal reduction. Can you explain a little bit about that and how do we account for it on the underwriting process if we actually do?
So what are they talking about, the principal reduction?
It on the financial is shown as an income. It just says principal reduction, and it shows like an income. It could be, I don't know, $30,000 or $20,000. Is that something that you're familiar with? And if so, how do we account for that on the underwriting? Or do we just not count it at all?
I'm not familiar with that. Are you, Jeff?
No, they're doing, they're giving you something that's tied into the existing terms or the existing mortgage that the seller has. So that one, there's no category or bucket for underwriting when you're underwriting the deal.
No.
Because.
And what I think they're doing is probably looking at the property package, and in it it has that term, principal reduction, meaning that they started out at a mortgage of, say, $5 million, and now they're down to, you know, 4.93, something like that. So I don't think that has any bearing on your particular underwriting.
Okay, because my concern was because I see it even on when it says when they mention proposed new loan and the terms they put in there, it also shows it there, like a new loan would have it. And also they account for that on their calculations on cap rates and everything, because of course it's an income, so the cap rates will go up and will be better for the numbers. But your recommendation is not to count it at all, just discard it and go with the rest of the numbers, not just that.
Well,
yeah,
if you think about it, right, like if you're underwriting the deal, right, what do you have for income coming in? You have the rent, right? And then you're taking out vacancies, concessions, non-payments. And then you have other income, which is typically laundry, vending, cable, things that you have at the property, plus like any type of late fees that are coming in, and utility reimbursements. So there's no – in the operations of the property, its principal reduction wouldn't apply to it because it's not something that – where are you getting that money from? You're getting it from – it's being taken off your mortgage. It's not something that's going on with the operations of the apartment complex.
I see your point, but some of those OMs, they show it like every year. They show that as a principal reduction, even on the pro formas. And
they're taking the property, right, and they're doing the pro forma out. It could be like they could be going out like 5 years and stuff. So they're probably like showing if you bought it at a certain price, because a lot of those OMs, right, you'll see is they have in-house lending. So they're showing you like what their lenders said that like they can do with the property based on like what they're giving out right now for terms and stuff like that. So it's added stuff, and like we always say, you look at where the real estate broker, they look at deals differently than we do. They look at what they can do in the future. So what they're giving you is like future things. So it wouldn't go in your analysis because you and the lender, you're taking expenses and income that are historical, that are going back like the last 12 months. Trailing and stuff, so yeah, they're like they're confusion. They're throwing that in, so that's what it is. It's some type of pro forma principal reduction
they're
trying to show you.
What I see too is they could be booby trapping themselves, because if they bought it for say $5 million and they've had it for 2 or 3 years and now they only owe about $4.2 million, but they're asking like $7 million, that could be a value play for you to play around with, knowing how much they really owe still on the property. It's not a booby trap for them to even put it in there.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Appreciate the help.
Okay.
All righty, man. I was just in Texas, Houston, last weekend, and there's this great restaurant called Papado's. Oh, my gosh. They had the best seafood, the best gumbo. It's like if you're in Texas, you know about it. But if you ever visit Texas.
I didn't
Texas,
like it.
It is
we went
so
there. I didn't like
good.
It.
Oh, you know, the chicken fingers probably weren't good, Jeannie.
Yeah, right.
Like, what'd you get?
Operator, any other questions right now?
Our next question comes from Jaime. Jaime, please state your question.
Hi, my name is Jaime Gasila, and we are from Sacramento, and we just joined Dave's program about last month. So we're currently doing a single family homes, and we have a little bit of money to invest. So what is your suggestion as far as investing the money? Is it better to invest on like 8 or 10 units here in our backyard?
I think it's a good idea to have something in your backyard, but if you can get something in a market that is not like California. California is so expensive, so maybe you have $100,000 and maybe you could be the only investor in your own property in a different market, such as Texas, or a market that's a lot less expensive than California.
Okay, so what would be the number of units that that's a good for us to start? We have like
whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah. Okay, because we have a property right now that we're renting here in Sacramento, which is cost about. I mean, we can probably turn 31 that for like. $500,000, so I don't know if people can.
So, I mean, you got to think that you're going to go over $1 million for a property, and if you're in California, that's not going to give you much. If you're outside of California, you're going to get a lot of property where you have, you know, money to put down. You're not going to have any other investors, so you're going to be 100% sole owners of. That's pretty cool.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
Okay. I have another question. This is from Alethea, and she's from Austin, Texas, and she has two questions. And she's asking me to answer both of them. Her first one is, while meeting other real estate professionals, I say I am an investor as well as an acquisition specialist. No one seems familiar with that title. Someone once called me a bird dog. Is an acquisition specialist the same as what is referred to as a bird dog in real estate, or should I avoid using that title as a point of reference? Well, for me, when I see acquisition specialists, I see the term as a highly skilled individual who looks at every unit mix, path of progress, and someone with a unique talent for finding the diamond in the rough. So I think those people that are calling you a bird dog don't know what an acquisition specialist really is. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I'll add to that too, right? Like the people that are asking if you have a bird dog, they probably have a single family like background. So what you could like just say, yeah, it's very similar to it's similar to a bird dog where we go in, we buy large multifamily properties with a strong back end. We look at the property itself, like Jeannie was saying, the unit mix, but we We look at the financials. We look to see if it's in a good market, if it's in a good neighborhood. We put everything together. We look at the lending terms. We do a lot. So being an acquisition specialist, it's not like really being a bird dog where you're looking to either wholesale as an extra strategy, or you're looking to rent the properties and things like that. It's like a higher end. So you're going to position yourself as being a multifamily expert when you say you can actually say you look at large multifamily properties in our own backyard, but in emerging markets, and that'll trigger them into saying, what's an emerging market? And that's when you say, oh, yeah, we go into markets that have strong job growth. And inside those markets, we're looking for the submarkets. We're looking for, and in those submarkets, we're looking for neighborhoods where we can get a strong back end. You can't tell them the type of returns that you're getting, but so you're really like that acquisition like specialist is like it's a pretty good title. It's an awesome title to introduce people to what you're doing in this multifamily business.
Her second question is, I came across a deal that I believe to be a good investment opportunity for the right investor, but it does not meet my criteria. I found a C property in a C class area that is very inexpensive and has a solid cash flow and add value opportunities. I found an investor who was interested in lower C class add value assets. Since I do not wish to be an equity partner, I want to give the investor the opportunity and capitalize on the acquisition fee. If I am not taking an equity share and I believe that they will be doing all of their own due diligence, can I still be confident about charging a 5% finder's fee, or should I adjust the fee? Oof. That, first off, an acquisition fee is what your investors are paying you for putting the deal together. So in this case, that doesn't work. Finder's fees are really not that common in multifamily. But if you could figure out the value of the property and maybe get a wholesaling figure at the closing table for bringing him the deal, that might be something. And then to add on to question two, if I just do the finding of the deal, but the buyer wants to do all of the due diligence and heavy lifting, what is the logical fee to charge? And I think if you're looking to wholesale the deal, or are you looking to keep your fingers in it, you have to decide what position you want to be in here. Do you want to just find deals and pass them off to somebody else as a broker? Get your real estate license. I mean, I don't know what, Jeff, do you want to add to that?
Well, it looks like she found a C property in the C area, and that's like she's looking for B properties in B areas. I would like, if you have an equity partner in it, then like, why not? If it's in a market that you're looking to, it's like, why not get into that deal with an equity partner and like and do some of the financials and get the experience and just add, you know, it's a good deal. Cash flow is good. Cash flow is cash flow. But if that equity partner has management experience with like that type of property, then have him as like be charged with that. He'll be a key principal that would be doing the management side of it, and then like a lot of the headaches will go away from the day-to-day operations or overseeing the management side. But like I would like, we used to buy C properties, they're a pain, right? But they cash flow. Mm-hmm. So we've been through
it. Yeah, I mean, if it's a C-class property, it can be a really good investment if it's in the right area. But if it's C-minus property in a D area, then I'd run the other way. But mm-hmm. if it's a C property in a C area, I mean, C could mean just the year it was built. Doesn't mean that it's in disrepair.
Yeah, a lot of times, like, can you change that tenant profile? If something happened in that market where that supposedly C area is going to turn into like B, you know, you can be able to like change the profile, then get more rent and stuff like that. So there's a lot of opportunities with the C properties, but I can understand, like, buying a C, it's like, it's not, like Jeannie always says, I'm buying a property where it's safe for my grandkids to live at, you know?
That's right. If I won't put my grandkids in it, I ain't buying it.
Yep.
And that's what you're, that's just me. I mean, a lot of people buy D-minus properties and they get a lot of money for them and they're fine, but I'm not going to let my grandkids go live there. Operator, do we have any other questions?
Our next question comes from Mark. Mark, please state your question.
Hi, Jeannie and Jeff. This is Mark and Angela from Summer, Massachusetts. How are you?
Good.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Great. We really enjoyed the commercial training this last weekend with Bob Bowman and everybody that was there. So it was great to hear about the commercial end of things. It's a little bit different than the multifamily, but still a lot of the same concepts and everything. What we're having the biggest problem doing, I think, is just in approaching people that we want to invest with us. And that's kind of your topic today. I just wanted to try to get back to that. I mean, we have some people that are interested in kind of nibbling at it, but still haven't really made too much of a commitment at investing. Do you find that you just have to keep after these people and just keep giving them information and educating them on the process? Or?
Well, for me, I think it is so much easier enticing somebody to invest with you if you have something to offer them. But if you don't have a property that you're working on, what are you going to tell them? So most people, I mean, how I raise money for Dave is I always bring up what Dave is getting out of the deal. Say Dave's getting 30% of the deal. The investors are getting 70%. Dave's getting a 5% acquisition fee. Now let's talk about what's in it for you. And then I go forward with everything about them so that they're comfortable knowing what they are in it for. But if you don't have a property to talk to them about, you should get some kind of a credibility sheet made up for yourself so that something like a spiel that you can say, you know, this is the kind of properties we're looking to buy in an emerging market. This is the kind of returns we expect to give, you know, an 8% preferred rate of return before we ourselves take any money. We're going to give the investors 8%. Just let them know what your intentions are. But right now, you don't have anything to tell them. So nobody's jumping through hoops to tell you, yes, find something, we'll invest with you, because you haven't made a statement yet.
Yeah, the credibility kit is a good idea. That's something we need to work on. Good point. What we have been trying to do is, you know, work with some of the other sponsors in their deals and, you know, try to bring other investors into those along with ourselves so they get some experience, you know, investing in real estate with people like, you know, the sponsors that have gone through this before, to try to give them a little bit more confidence that, you know, this is tried and true by other people already. And so to try to give them a comfort level. But
here's the thing. I mean, I would take this offline if you want me to, but you can't give your investors to somebody else because then they're not yours anymore.
Right.
You just gave them away. You've got to keep your investors close to the vest. I mean, you can explain to them how other people's deals are cash flowing, and you can yourself invest in somebody else's deal, but don't give your investors to someone else because you just lost them.
Yeah, well, these are people that we know pretty well, but you're right, because they were more comfortable, you know, they say that, well, if it's your deal, I'll invest with you, but if it's someone else's, we don't know anything about them, really. So, yeah, I guess that's a good point. That's something that we were trying to, you know, help use their experience to help move us along and educate ourselves and make us all a little bit of money in the process. But I guess if we're focused on our own properties, then it's going to be a little more in line with what makes them comfortable and ourselves, I guess. So, yeah, good point. Yeah. All right, Jeannie. Well, thank you. I appreciate your help in this. It's good to hear all the different sides because, you know, you get certain ideas in your mind that you think, okay, let's try this, and, you know, you try and it doesn't work, but you want to, you know, that's what, it's really good to be able to have you and Jeff and the whole group there to help guide us toward success here. So thank you again.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Mark,
good luck
another
to you,
thing
Mark.
I'd like to, another thing I'd like to add is like maybe you want to keep them engaged with things that you're doing, right? If you're like checking out a new market or you see like a new article that like I'm from multi-housing news, you know, maybe a value add, like you could just send them like a quick email every like, you know, like every 2 or 3 weeks so they know that you're still doing it, like you're still actively looking, like if there's any news that's coming up. And then like during the holidays, we always reach out to our investors and like send them Dave's Emerging Market book. Or if you have a new investor that like doesn't really understand why you're looking at other markets outside of Boston, you know, you can send them the Emerging Market book so they can read it and say, oh, yeah, this is what he's doing.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Hey, Mark, if you have a handful of investors, 5 or 6 of them, set up a mastermind group that you can meet with them once a month and let them know how you're progressing. Meet at Panera Bread or one of those places and just engage with them so that they know that you're working towards the same goal, that you're going to buy something, they're going to put up the money, you're all going to share in the cash flow, but keep them ever present that you're their guide.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Let's not try to give our investors away, right?
No, you don't want to do that.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a good point. I think that's a good idea. Get together on a regular basis and keep educating them until they're comfortable and we find the right deal to make it all happen. So,
yeah,
good points. Yeah, okay.
And that's always great if you can have the money and know that you've got the money to close a deal when you get this diamond come through that nobody else has looked at. You just say, you know, I can close this because I know the money is lined up waiting for me.
Right. Well, that's another good point because it's the comfort level of knowing the cash is sitting there, or you at least have commitments, because I know a lot of people have, you know, just go into deals and sign up and then get the investors after, and I think that's how it happens a lot of times. But I'm not very comfortable without thinking I have a few people lined up that are ready to do that, and I guess that's what's kept me made me hesitant about going ahead and putting in a bunch of LOIs without having people like that ready. So, yeah. All right. Well, we'll try to set something up like that, some meetings, because we have a few people that we could do that with, and maybe that's the format we should take it in the future. So.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
All right.
Well,
Have a happy Easter now.
You too, Jeannie. Thanks again, and appreciate your help. You too, Jeff.
Yep. Take care.
Okay. We'll see you.
Yep.
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
Okay, I have another one that was sent in from John G. in Sacramento. I am new to the business, and I am getting mixed signals about using hard money for my deals. In my single-family business, I used hard money all the time for my deals, but now I am getting people who are telling me that hard money is not good to use for multifamily. My question, is it a good idea to use hard money for a down payment in multifamily, or is it better to use a private investor? Well, my answer is it's better to use a private money person because you're giving them a piece of the deal, and they're more apt to come in and stay with you if they're getting cash flow throughout the deal. It's a lot less expensive, and they are in the deal from the beginning until the end. Hard money is very expensive. You're paying high interest in points. Say you can't cash them out for 3 years or 5 years. Hard money could cost just as much of the deal by the time you are done. Between paying the points, I mean, it's hugely expensive. If you're thinking of a debt partner as hard money, that is not what I consider the same. Debt partners are people that don't get any equity in the deal. They get a simple interest, 10%, 11% every year, like clockwork, and they're in the deal for 3 to 5 years, then you pay that interest, and then you cash them back out with their original deposit, and you own the deal outright. But if you're thinking of hard money, I mean, you could be paying 15, 16% interest on that money. It would be crazy. You want to add anything, Jeffrey?
No, you nailed it, Jeannie.
Okay, so any other questions, operator?
We currently have no callers with questions.
Okay, this is very unusual. Usually I am so busy with questions I can't get to them all. So people are taking a hiatus today. So
yeah,
this is another question that was sent in. If I don't have rich friends or family members, what is the best place to start finding money? Neighbors, you can go to the Chamber of Commerce and make a little presentation. Go to your RIA clubs. Let people know what you're doing, your workplace. Talk to people. Tell them, you know, you're buying multifamily properties. You'd love for them to check out what you're doing. Maybe come and look at the property, and maybe they'll loosen up their wallet once they get activated and jump right in. Anything to add, Jeffrey?
Tell people to press *0 to be able to ask questions. Someone just came in late, so they don't know how to ask questions.
Okay. Okay, the next thing is, when is the best time to do a walkthrough of the property? Well, once you put the LOI in and it gets accepted, that's when your due diligence starts. So that's when you're going to go and do a walkthrough of the property. If you want to know prior to putting in an LOI, you could send in a secret shopper and have the shopper give you a report on the property. But if it's something you have under contract, you want to walk every single solitary unit with a licensed inspector to make sure that there's no stone left unturned. Anything to add, Jeff?
Anything to add? Yeah, if you have it on a contract, right, and you've been talking to property managers, as far as you get team build in, send a property manager to do a drive-by, have them look at the CapEx, the deferred maintenance, the roofs, the parking lot, things like that. And then look at your underwriting notes, and did you carry enough for CapEx? Did you carry enough for repair and maintenance? Have the property manager also look to see if there's any code violations as they go through. They'll do an assessment for you, and then have them get back, and because you're gonna be talking to the broker and asking them about those items. But if there's a conflict or a misrepresentation, then that's the time to do the retrading before you go down and see that property. So, how's that? Is that a good ad?
I like that.
Okay.
We make a good team, you and I. So the next question I got was, on my first deal, how many units should I be looking for? I mean, the bigger the better, but if you're comfortable doing smaller deals, get a bunch of fourplexes in the same little neighborhood. I mean, it's whatever you're comfortable doing. I can't say go out and buy a 500-unit building if you're not comfortable doing it, but if you're comfortable with 100 units, do that. It's whatever you're comfortable with.
All right. Just in case people don't know who Jeannie is, Jeannie's the one that raises all the money for us. She
And like she's like that's what she does here. She's an investor relationships. She just did a bunch of K-1s and stuff like that. Like, I'm surprised no one has any questions about anything that has to do with private money, because like that's one of the things you need to be doing, looking for deals, looking for markets, looking for private money. Jeannie, why don't you, because you mentioned a term, and I'm not sure if people knew what it was, like the 8% preferred return. Do you want to, like, a lot of people, like, they know what the Holy Trinity is, 8%, but, like, could you, like, refer, like, just do a little review on some of the structures on how you, to bring investors in?
Sure. Well, sometimes when you have a property, it could be a higher class property, maybe an A or a B-plus property. Your returns are not going to come right out of the gate at, say, 15%. They might come in right out of the gate at 9%, and you might need 6 to 8 months to bring up the rents on the units as they become due, or you might do a little bit of a repair on some of the units to get the higher rents, such as putting laminate countertops or whatever they need. So what happens is you offer your investors an 8% preferred rate of return before you take a penny. So if it cash flows 9% right out of the gate, they're getting the first 8 and you're getting 1. Once you even off the returns, we used to do it so they'd get an 8% preferred rate of return, then it would be a 90-10 split until we became equal. So Dave would get 0.90, the investors would get 8.1, then 10% and 11%, therefore. So when you both become equal, so you're both getting 8%.
So the overall deal is bringing in a 16% cash-on-cash return?
Yep. Then okay. You do a 50-50 split from the cash flow moving forward. So a lot of people look at a deal that doesn't have a big, huge value play, knowing that their investors are going to be happy with that 8% return until you can make it higher. A lot of our deals, we might start out, we always are very conservative in our underwriting, giving off more into CapEx than probably we need, but we want to make sure that the money is there in case the bank tells us we have to have X amount of dollars. So we might start out saying that on one deal, it was called Eagle Point, we told the investors it was going to be a 12% cash-on-cash return year one. Well, year one, it ended up being 17.4% to the investors and 17.4% to Dave and his partner. So we always are conservative in our delivery of information because you really want to, you know, underpromise and overdeliver. So on the 8% preferred rate of return, that's terminology that came out around 2012, I believe, maybe 2011, right after the banks went belly up, if you will, and the auto industry was having all of that trouble, and the government came in and swooped down like the Superman they are and helped them all get liquid again. You're doing the same thing with your properties. So you're giving them a preferred rate of return to ensure that if it comes in at 8%, they're getting it all. If it comes in at 7.9%, they get it all. If it comes in at 9%, you're getting 8.1, and we're getting 0.90, and so forth and so on, so that the investors are assured that they get paid first, which is always the case, but because of that downturn, that's how we were doing it.
That was very good. I'm trying to think of questions that I could ask because I don't want to press star zero.
We have a couple of participants with questions. Our next question comes from Alicia. Alicia, please state your question.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeannie.
Hey,
hi.
What's going on?
Can you hear me?
So you're the acquisition specialist, aren't you?
No. No. I'm the one from California, not Texas.
Okay.
I wanted to backtrack a little bit on what you were talking about with the LOI and the viewing. Someone told me, that was very seasoned in this business told me that they do not put in an LOI until they view the property first and then put the LOI in. And my experience, and the little experience that I have in this, I put an LOI in and I expected them to take a few days to mill it around and come back to me and that sort of thing. They came back to me immediately countering my LOI, and I had not even seen the property yet. So that kind of spooked me a little bit, knowing that if they came back that fast, that there must be something wrong with the property. So, and I wasn't in the position to go view the property immediately like that. So I was just kind of curious how you would balance that of whether or not to view the property first and put an LOI, or else put an out, submit the LOI, as you were saying, and then go view the property and find out. The other question I have on that one was, if you submit the LOI and you haven't viewed the property, how do you know how much CapEx to put in it?
I'll give you a short answer on that. I Google everything. I can find out a ton of stuff on a property just by Googling comments by the residents. I can, you know, go on the website and see what they've posted up there, call the police department, find out if they've been to the property and the reasons why. Is it domestic? Is it drugs? What the heck's going on? So Google is amazing. As far as viewing the property, you got to give yourself time to get the LOI accepted and then go out there. I mean, why spend money on a secret shopper or even having a new property manager go out and view and drive through the place if you have no idea if you're going to buy it or not?
Right. Well, so, then that was the other, that's what was going through my head, is that that would get really costly to go view properties and not submit LOIs,
right?
Unless they're in your backyard.
Definitely.
But on your comment here of Googling the property, I did do that. I checked in with the crime on the property, and they had quite a bit of crime on the property, isolated incidents. But it wasn't until, and what I did do was had, I'm working with Jeff Kissy, as you probably know, so I was, he recommended somebody to go out there to view the property, which I had her do. And she's the one who told me, she was a property manager out that way, and she's the one who told me of all the problems that the property had. So I did it that way. She was quite seasoned in her experience with that sort of thing. And it turned out that it had substantially a lot more problems than what was noted in the OM and other places. So I was just kind of curious what that balance is. How do you know what to do with it? How do you know where to go with it? Is it just a
hit
and miss?
Well, I'll just give one little comment, and then we'll listen to Jeff. But okay. Your broker, the broker that brought you the deal,
uh-huh,
he should have enough faith in you to know the kinds of properties that you're going to buy and the things that he's not going to get away with giving to you. So,
uh-huh,
evidently, in this case, he just was trying to get one over on you.
Hmm. Okay. Or do you think he was just not experienced in the property? He's up in Amarillo, and this property was down in Longview. So I don't know if he was really familiar with the area. Is that a possibility?
It could be.
I mean, I think he's a nice guy. I kind of trust him.
Was it his listing, though?
No, it's somebody else's listing. He just reached out.
Jeff, what do you think?
Okay, so what do I think? Well, you did the right thing. Is you got the property under contract, and you sent a property manager by there, and like they told you what you got her take on it on the deferred maintenance. So then, taking what she had, but also like we on our letter of intent and the one that we have on the mastery site that. I think it's like the sample is like the Tory's case study. It lists like about 14 different items that you're expecting from the seller. And if you look at that, it's pretty similar to your financial due diligence. So we want to start seeing, we want to see the last like 2 years, year to dates. So we have an idea of what's going on with the expenses. We want to see a 3-year CapEx report, seeing what they put into the building. And so then you know how many roofs were replaced, when was parking lot last done, if it was done in the last 3 years. And you'll get that if the seller has some kind of like financing on the property, they definitely have CapEx because that lender, if the seller just owns it free and clear, then you won't be able to get a CapEx. But then you look at that CapEx, so then you have an idea of what's going on with the CapEx. And then with that drive-by, which is great, you know, like Coach Jeff Kissy, like that was a great thing to do, to have someone do the drive-by, and you got your input. So now, so now you can go back and you can like retrade. And that broker that you're working with, that's why we try to work with listing brokers, because they get they'll get all that stuff because they're more motivated because they're getting the complete like commission on it. But we do work with like this real estate broker, and he might be good, right? Because he kind of knew what your criteria was, like the type of markets that you're looking at. But this property just had too much like going on with it, so I wouldn't like I'd keep working with him to see what he can pull out. But try to like see if he has any of his own listings too, and that's what you really want to target. But yeah, you did everything. So you don't want to drive out there and look at every property. You want to look at the financials first, and then we don't especially if it's in a new market. Now if this isn't a market that you've already been looking into, that you know what's out on the market right now, you know where the good neighborhoods are and things like that, you've really dove into the market, then you might consider going out there, but you have other properties to look at. You know, you're looking at we break it down on in the conference called site visits. It's like near the end. Mm-hmm. I think it's like if you go through that, we have that laid out like with the four different things. You know, you have like an offer in on the property. You have to jump on a plane. You have to go out there and see it because like then so we have it like who you see it, and it's like. The way we do it is as if you're flying in on a Friday night and you leave and you're flying out on Sunday, like what the things to do to make the best use of your time. Because you don't want to be like flying out looking at a property and then Jesus, that didn't work out. So we have like we have a whole thing on what to do up in that on that website. But the way you approach that deal, that was the right way. Yeah. You know, you got feedback, you know, you contacted the broker. Said, hey, you know, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of issues going on this property. So it's like good, and you look good, too. You look good that you had someone in that market that could go over there. So you did all the right things on that deal.
Yeah, she was
and the thing you didn't do, you didn't jump on an airplane and, like, fly out there. That was good.
Yeah,
you know?
It cost me a fruit basket, but it was worth it. So a little bit about that. I had the CapEx that they had put in there, and they had mentioned that they put granite countertops and, you know, new roofs and these kind of things. And she had mentioned that some of the units did have that, some of them didn't, which is fine because that allows me to put the rest of the units up to par and be able to raise the rents on those. That's exactly what we want, right? But
yep.
What was happening with the financials was that they were such a mishmash. Apparently, they had just somebody had bought the property in 2014 and took it over from some sort of a rehab situation, foreclosure, I'm not sure what it was. So the financials were just a total mess. And I had three different people look at those financials, and they got three different answers on what should be on that. So it was really confusing. And I wasn't quite feeling confident enough that all the financials, you know, with three different answers, what was the right answer? I mean, it was just really hard to tell on that one. But it's, yeah. So we're still negotiating it, but it's been an interesting process, a very learning process, I have to say.
You know, we owned a property in Amarillo.
Yes, I saw you on the list. You also have one in Longview.
Yeah, we have one in Longview, and, you know, we have it under contract for sale, and the investors are getting all of their money back plus a 95.4% profit.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It's a very nice property, very well laid out, very spread out,
mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I was just taken aback a little. I thought, oh, look at that. I guess we're in the right place. okay, well, thank you for your information. I appreciate it.
Always good hearing from you, Alicia.
Me too. I hope to see you guys soon.
I hope so, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Up next, we have Paul. Paul, please state your question.
Hey, Jeannie. Hey, Jeff. It's Paul. How are you?
Paul, I was communicating with Lisa earlier. I love the new logo. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Hey,
you're
listen,
welcome.
When Lisa and I have been doing our underwriting recently, you know, based upon conversations that we've had with the two sponsors that we've been dealing with, we've been told that because of the interest rates starting to rise now, we need to protect ourselves, you know, for, you know, potential reductions in value down the road, and the way to do that is to have a larger spread between what we're using for an exit cap versus what the entry cap is,
mm-hmm.
And we're using at this point we're using a point and a half. Is that reasonable or is that too much? What would you guys recommend?
A point and a half for interest rate.
On the cap rate. In other words, if the cap rate is listed on the entry of the on the purchase at say 7%, when we're figuring our when we're doing our pro forma, we should use an exit cap of 8.5. If we're at 7 going in, we should be at an 8.5 getting out, say 5 years, 7 years down the road. Is when we're doing our underwriting, is that too much of a spread, or is that an appropriate spread?
If you heard that from Bob, he does a lot with those forecasts. I really don't know what you would use. I know we go with 3% for income and 2% for expenses as far as.
On income and expense growth, yeah, that's what we use. Is usually
yeah.
We use 3 and 2, yeah.
But as far as the cap rate goes, I don't know.
Okay, Jeff, do you have any insight in that regard?
Yeah, well, if you use the same cap that you're going in and going out at, that's a good way of doing
yeah.
it too. Yeah. So,
yeah.
You
don't want to get bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to get bit, Paul.
No, I know. So if we use the same, that puts us in a, you know, it certainly makes our numbers look better, but does it give us enough protection is the question, I guess. I guess it all depends on when you're talking to a sponsor. It's what their risk tolerance is, I guess, right? So
yeah, and what the area is too, and what's going on in that area. If you're getting a lot of new jobs coming into the marketplace, forecasted jobs. So say a Boeing plant is going to go in and produce 5,000 to 10,000 jobs, and I take them 2-3 years to get that all up and running, then you can increase a little. But if you don't see anything in the horizon coming on, I say safer is better.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I guess it depends on who we're working with as far as a sponsor is concerned. I mean, in order to get them, in order to make them feel comfortable, they have their own criteria that they follow. And as far as their investors are concerned, the folks that they're going to be bringing into the deal, that's what they, they use their, certain or very specific criteria so that they know that they're protecting their investors as well, I guess, is the answer.
Mm.
So, but, That was really a concern I had as to whether or not we're being too conservative or not being conservative enough, depending upon the delta between the entry and the exit cap rate. Because we're finding we're getting outbid a lot of times.
I don't think you're alone.
No, huh?
I think it's a seller's market in most of these bigger areas, and they have this emotional attachment to the property, so they're just putting it out there. A lot of people are putting, property packages out and prices to be determined, because they're looking to give them a ballpark of what somebody will pay.
Yeah, I know. I hate those type of OMs when they come out like that, those property packages, price to be determined by market, right? So, what we do is we call the broker and say, what are you guys, whispering? Where do you think it's coming in? And obviously, they want to get the highest price they can for their sellers. So, they're going to give us the highest, they're going to try to force the market to reach that number. But what we're seeing, what we were told, is that the spread between the buy and the sell now is around 10%. So it's starting to...
I do notice a lot of portfolio deals are coming into play, for students that are looking for us to analyze them. There are multiple deals in one property package.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned earlier in the call that we might want to consider commercial, triple net deals or storage facilities.
Yeah.
Is that because of the fact that it's a seller's market in multifamily right now?
Not every market is seller's market. The submarkets, there's still a lot of growth left. But
yeah, I know. There's about half
market,
of them. The articles that we've been seeing lately show that about half the markets right now are still have plenty of growth in them. I guess we just
have to find that niche market that you can go in there and buy. But in the meantime, I'd be looking at office, because business is creeping up and people need a place.
Yep.
I mean, our retail, we thought we were going to be around 10% returns to the investors. It's already at 12 and climbing. So
is it really? Is that medical office specifically,
no,
or is that just general?
No, that one there is the retail that we have as a strip mall. But our office complexes, they are just cash flowing like cows right now.
Really?
The one we have in North Carolina, J.P. Morgan holds 70% of the space, and they're looking to get more space. And they've got a 30-year lease, and they're going nowhere. And that thing is just pumping out money. And
that's
we have
great.
One in Texas that is cash flowing too, 100% occupied, all triple net leases, and nobody's going anywhere. So those are the kinds of properties. If you can get a nice small medical office building, or those are frosting on the cake, as far as I can see.
Yeah. Okay. Good to hear. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, listen. Have a happy Easter.
Hey, you too, Paul. Take care.
Take care. Bye now.
Our next question comes from David. David, please state your question.
Maybe David got tired of waiting.
Maybe.
Okay, I'll go to the next participant. Our next participant question comes from Paul Williams. Paul, please state your question.
Hey there. Got a question about the, and by the way, my name is Paul. I'm from Marble Falls, Texas, near San Antonio and Austin. On the preferred rate of return, you kind of went into it, but I just wanted to make sure I understand it. So if you tell your partners you're getting a preferred rate of return of 8%, if it only comes in at 7, then they get 7%, and that other percent, you're not on the hook for it later at any time, right?
No, no.
Okay.
No, if, however it comes in, whether you pay monthly or quarterly, if it comes in at 7%, you're giving them all of that. Now, say, you know, you pay quarterly, and the first quarter it comes in at 7%, but the second quarter it comes in and it's like 8.5%, and it's going to climb up for the rest of the year. Just you add all those figures together, and the average return ends up being like 8.5 or 9 for that 1 year.
So then you would pay the preferred rate of return whenever you're giving a distribution or annually?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, you pay the preferred rate of return for the quarter as it comes in, but you might talk about it as an 8% preferred rate of return for the year. But if it comes in on the first quarter at 7.5 or whatever it is, that's the rate you pay. But in the next quarter, if it comes in higher, you pay that next quarter. So when you add it all up for the end of the year, it might come in higher than 8%. But you're taking your rate of return too. So like if it comes in at 8.5, they're going to get 8, and you're going to get 0.5. So you have to do some catch-up here so that you get money too. But say this windfall happens and you've raised all the rents and it's 100% occupied and now you're really setting the cash flow. Once it evens off so that both of you are getting 8% or higher, then you're going to 50-50 split.
Okay, but like if you had 12% the first quarter, mm-hmm. and then you ended up with 7% all of the other quarters,
mm-hmm.
then would you pay the average over the year or you pay the return each quarter?
You pay the return each quarter.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, I think that answers all my questions. So thank you.
Our next question comes from Kathy. Kathy, please state your question.
Was the caller Kathy?
Okay, Kathy, you're up. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. Hi, my name is Kathy. My husband and I just joined this program 2 weeks ago, and we're trying to determine what markets to invest in, what emerging markets. We're based outside the D.C. area, Northern Virginia. It's fairly expensive here, so we're interested in some smaller emerging markets. And my question is, how frequently should we be intending to go there? And is it, just to get started, is it better to find an emerging market that it's like 3 or 4 hours away that we could drive to? Or should we be going to a market, say, like Huntsville, which is a really great market, but that we would have to fly to? Or does it matter?
Did you say you're from the Virginia area?
Yeah, just Washington, D.C. metro area in Northern Virginia.
Okay, well, you know, Richmond is a great market.
Okay, that's close, yes.
And I would go to Richmond Mike Flaherty just closed a $23 million deal over there, and a bunch of the sponsors are closing deals over in that Richmond corridor. You know, so that's a market I would pick. I mean, Washington, D.C. has a lot of appreciation going on, and Baltimore just relaxed some of their zoning laws. So they have put in some zoning opportunities. Annapolis is a good market. Salisbury, Maryland's a good market. There are a lot of good markets in your backyard there.
Okay. All right. I guess for myself, for Baltimore, I'd have to figure out which ones are safe. I don't have grandkids, but which ones I'd be safe in myself. Scares me
a
little.
Well, I think truthfully, I think a lot of our students have stayed away from Baltimore itself because there has been no zoning. So we always tell people to stay clear of it unless you live there. So what I would be doing is I would be going on to the websites for the government and see which ones they relaxed and go check those areas out.
Pardon my ignorance here, but I don't understand what you mean by they relaxed the zoning rules.
Well, meaning that I shouldn't use the word relax. There has been no zoning in Baltimore, but now they've put in place that you can't put like a single family beside a gas station. So they've enforced the rules better. And I would find out what areas that they chose to do that in, because not all areas have been done in Baltimore.
So find out what areas they're enforcing the zoning?
Yes.
And then invest there?
Yeah. Because you won't have a lot of competition, not from our students, because we've always told them to stay clear of it. But now that last month they have enforced zoning, you know, it might open some doorways for you.
Okay. Is Richmond getting overcrowded with students looking there?
I don't know, but I know it's been on this emerging market list for at least 6 weeks, so it could be. It could be getting crowded, but it's whoever gets that deal.
There's always competition in any market, so I wouldn't like
that.
There's competition
everywhere.
About that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Well, Kathy, while I have you on the phone.
Yes.
Oh, will you be attending the immersion training in Baltimore? I sent out like a confirmation form a couple weeks ago. I mean, not a couple weeks ago. Last week. Well, look for two emails from me, right? One of them was for...
I sent it to somebody who's...
Oh, Vanessa?
Vanessa, yeah. Yeah, I sent the confirmation
cool.
in. We'll be there, and you're going to be in Arlington, I think. So we'll be there. Save people on the bus for us.
Excellent. and then your student data form. I'm not sure if you sent that over. Like, I haven't looked... I looked a couple of days ago. Have you been able to fill out that student data form yet? If you haven't, I can resend you offline.
We can take this offline. We'll see it over. Yeah, no problem. We had told when we sent up, we said we're going to be ready June 1st to start the coaching. So.
Oh, June 1st. Oh, okay, good.
That
worked.
That's why we're not like getting everything right back to you. So.
Oh, and it's actually good, Greg, because then I'll be able to spend like that weekend with you, really get to know you and stuff like that. So, that's fine. I just put that note into my thing. I just wanted to make sure. Wasn't going to your spam box and things like that. So, that's cool.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Good. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. All right.
Our last question comes from David. David, please state your question.
Yes, hello. I tried to ask my question before, but unfortunately I got cut off, came back on, and I guess they didn't unmute my phone. I am new to this. I was in the Baltimore course last weekend, but I do have some questions. I actually have two questions. One, I found a small multifamily house, like a six family, It had great value add because it was managed by the owners, old couple. The man had a stroke, and he's like being forced to leave his business behind as long as this Sikh family. Is there a way I could wholesale this by doing a value add for the time of raising rent in the meantime? Also, my second question is, when I contact some realtors, they don't like to give me a lot of proper information, or they give me their suggested information, which I guess makes the numbers better for them. Should I ask to speak to the management company before making an offer, or make the offer and then try to reach the management company?
You won't be talking to the management company at all. You'll be going through that real estate broker. And plus, you want to build that relationship, because if you do do that, then the broker won't be too happy that you're talking to the management company or the seller. So you want to talk to that management company. If you use the script from the you want to talk to that real estate broker. If you use the script from the Multifamily Millions training, it keeps you in control. You just just read it, right? So, and then maybe change a couple of the words so you don't sound like Dave from Boston, you know? So you use them like words that you're comfortable with, so it doesn't sound like you're reading off a script. So practice that a couple of times. You can even practice in another market. Just call up a couple of brokers, right? Go through it and so you have it down, you know? Or have someone listen to you do it. So you sound smooth, so you're acting as if you're an investor. And that'll get away from a lot of the financials, but with six families, anything that's below 40, you're gonna have those financials. They're not on a good spreadsheet, so it's not something the broker can just send over to you. A lot of times, those are they're waiting to get them from the seller, things like that. So usually with the smaller deals, it's harder to get the financials, and that's where you need to start looking at that market, find out what's insurance going for in this area, what are the taxes in this area. That type of property, or you can also look at other listings that are on the market right now to get an idea where's the broker that's creating a good package for you to look at. Where do they think the taxes are at? Where do they think the insurance is? What's a good management company getting in this market to do that size so you can almost creating your own operating expenses?
Or do you even need a manager for that? I mean, why pay payroll when you can pay a real estate agency, half of 1 month's rent to lease up the property and get somebody that lives on the property to do some, bird dogging for you, just checking around to make sure that everything's on the up and up, and maybe give them $50 a month reduction in rent for being your eyes and your ears when you're not there.
Okay. So let me re-ask my question about maybe wholesaling a multifamily deal. It was in Westminster, Virginia. It's an old couple. They're asking way too much for the house, especially since when he had a stroke, he had a business in one of the apartments. I think it was the highest grossing rent, and the income from the business, and also, of course, his health. So they only made $2,000 in income last year. The other years it was much more. Do I offer a ridiculously low offer because of the numbers? And can I wholesale that? Or should I hold that for the value add?
Well, it depends on what business you want to be in to make. If you want to be in the multifamily owners business, buy the property. I like to use a rule of thumb. If it's a six family, I like to use the rule of thumb. It's 50% expenses compared to income. So you take the average rents for each apartment and multiply them up for the year, and then take 50% of that for the expenses, and just see if you've got a deal, and reduce the price until you get the Trinity numbers, if you're going to use investor money to get the deal.
Okay. And you said, see if the expenses are 50% of the income, or I'm sorry,
well,
I kind of missed.
Well, see, in Baltimore, in Baltimore, or even in the Northeast area, most of the time you can average out the expenses before you get actuals at around 50%. So if the income's $100, you know the expenses are going to be at least 50.
Okay.
That's a good, that's taking a lot of the risk out. 50%, that's a good conservative number to do. And look at what your debt service is. And then you get your cash flow per month.
And then you get a cash flow. And if you think you can make it work with your investors, then I would be in the multifamily acquiring business, not in the wholesale business.
Okay. Well, I just wasn't sure what to do with this. I guess coming from a single family background, where a lot of times if the deal may seem hard, I may just wholesale and make some money that way. I guess in this, you try to make the deal work, period.
Yeah, we try to make the deal work, because if you make the deal work and that broker's going to get a payday, you're going to have that broker in your back pocket. But if that broker finds out that he brought you a deal and you wholesaled it to somebody else, you'll be hard-pressed to get him to bring you another deal.
Okay, I understand. Thank you very much.
Any questions, operator?
We have no questions at the time.
Okay, Jeffrey, what do you say?
That would do it. That's that was a great call. And thank you, Jeannie.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Like to have you as my sidekick.
You bet. All right, everybody.
All righty. Have a great Easter, everybody. Get your student data forms in. Get your immersion training forms in. And call us if you need us. We're here. Bye-bye now.
Bye.